14. You remember the context of this is Moses is now in the house of Pharaoh. He's actually brought up in his own home with his mother. But she took Moses to the house of Pharaoh, and there he is learning the ways of the Egyptians. And indeed, as we talked about last time, that was preparatory for when he would come back and do battle against the Egyptians. He was learning and taking it all in, the language and the various aspects of Egyptian culture. Now, what happens beginning in verse 11? One day, when Moses had grown up, he went out to his people and looked on their burdens. And saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people. He looked this way, that, seeing no one, he struck down the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. When he went out the next day, both two Hebrews were struggling together, and he said to the man in the wrong, "Why do you strike your companion?" He answered, "Who made you a prince and a judge over us? You mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" Then Moses was afraid and thought, "Surely the thing is known." Now here we have the first act of Moses recorded in the scriptures. He goes out and sees the Hebrews, his people. I mean, it's something, you know, get the movie out of your head. He knew that he was a Hebrew. Pharaoh's daughter knew that he was a Hebrew. She said he's one of the Hebrew children. He grew up with the Hebrews, who was in his mother's house and so forth. So, get the bad drama out of your head. The drama's good enough here. And he goes out to see his people and has compassion for them, because they are under severe burdens, as we looked at in chapter 1 of Exodus, that they are being persecuted, and the male children are being thrown into the Nile River. There's a Holocaust that is occurring here. Moses then sees an Egyptian thrashing a Hebrew. And in response, Moses kills the Egyptian. It's an interesting story, isn't it? The question is, how do we understand this? How do we understand Moses killing an Egyptian? Some commentators have tried to argue that Moses was justified in this act by some special dispensation from above. That is, that God was making an exception here and directed Moses to kill the Egyptian and deliver the oppressed Hebrew. And then this commentator could see, well, this is kind of a foretaste of what Moses would later do when he delivers the entire nation of Israel out of Egypt. It was a mere foretaste of that. Now, that seems to me a fair option, even though there's no evidence of a divine impulse mentioned in the text. It's not fair at all, isn't it? In support of that position, however, in your Bibles, let's go to the New Testament, the book of Acts, in Stephen's speech in Acts chapter 7, verses 23 through 25. Acts chapter 7, 23 through 25. And remember, in this speech of Stephen, he gives an overview of the history of Israel. And listen to what he says about Moses, beginning in verse 23. But when he was 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brothers, the children of Israel. And seeing one of them being wrong, he defended the oppressed man and avenged him by striking down the Egyptian. He supposed that his brothers would understand that God was giving them salvation by his hand, but they did not understand. It seems to me that in that passage, Moses is being put in a more favorable light. He saw one oppressed, stepped in, delivered the man, and apparently there's an impulse here in verse 25. He supposed that they would understand that he was going to deliver the people of Israel. Apparently God had prompted that intent. And so that's one position that is taken in understanding Moses' activity in Exodus chapter 2. Others would argue that Moses, perhaps, was acting upon his own impulse. But this killing was a sinful act that he should not have done. That here, the soon-to-be lawgiver is breaking the sixth commandment, which he would later give at Mount Sinai, although that law is earlier revealed, Genesis chapter 9, and Moses, you shall not kill a man. So it wasn't the first time that was revealed. Now, it seems to me that perhaps this is right, that this is quite sinister here. Look at verse 12, where it says, he saw this Egyptian being Hebrew under the people, and verse 12, he looked this way and that way, and not seeing anyone, he killed the Egyptian. Some on the other side of the aisle say, well, he was actually seeing that someone was going to come and rescue the Hebrew. And when he saw no one, he graciously stepped into the situation and saved the Hebrew. And then hit him in the sand. It seems a little sinister to me. He looks this way, he looks that way. I think he was looking for someone in vain. I think he was looking to see if anyone was looking. They weren't. And so Moses responds by killing the Egyptian. In addition, understand here, the Egyptian is not killing the Hebrew. It says that he's beating the Hebrew. Moses responds by then killing the Egyptian. It's a vengeful, it seems to me, a vengeful type of activity that is going on here. And I see the hair standing up in the back of your neck. This is Moses. This is Charles Heston. How can you say that about this guy? Well, no different than the eyes. The scriptures present men how they really are. Present the man who was after God's own heart was a murderer, an adulterer, a liar, a cheat. Yet God, by his grace, saved David. Here, and I think how we understand Acts chapter 7, is that Moses supposed that he was being called to be delivered. But he had not been called, actually. He's not called until Genesis chapter, or until Exodus chapter 3. That's when the call comes. He has had not had that call yet. And so, here again, I'm not, you know, salvation does not depend upon this interpretation, but to show that there are two sides to this interpretation, and I think that what we see here is a sinful man who does a sinful activity, whom God later uses to deliver the people of Israel. Now, does God use sinful people to bring about his purpose? God bring use murderers to bring about his good ends? Yes, David is a great example of that, as I think is Moses in this particular case. Does God text. It's a great story. I think I've told the story before. I can't remember. Get all that stuff. But back in the 18th century, there was a young man who was finishing his seminary work at Yale University. He was in his last semester. He had always felt called to go into the ministry. And there were just a couple weeks of school left. I think this is Great Warning Seminarians. That he and a number of his friends were sitting out in one of the lobbies of the school, and they were talking about their professors, and he said about one of his professors, "He's about as spiritual as this chair I'm sitting in." Now, that may be true, but it's not a good thing to say. And it got back to the professor. And it got back to the seminary. And he was expelled from the seminary. He came back, apologized to the professor, apologized to the seminary, and they wouldn't let him back in. So, he despaired, questioned why God would have done this to him. He had spent all this time trained to go into the gospel ministry. How could God allow this to happen? Thus began the call of David Brainerd to the Indians in western Massachusetts. Went and there were great revivals among the Indians in western Massachusetts. And God used sinful people and sinful things. Yes, He's sovereign. All things unfold according to the decree of God. All things. And so I don't think we should hide from the sin of men that we see, that God uses sinful men. That doesn't give us license to sin. It doesn't give them license to sin. But yes, God abuses sinful men to bring about His good purposes. Now, note what happens in verses 13 and 14. When he went out the next day, behold, two Hebrews were struggling together. And he said to the man in the wrong, "Why do you strike your companion?" He answered, "Who made you a prince and a judge over us? You mean to kill me if you kill the Egyptian?" But Moses was afraid and thought, "Surely the thing is known." So you have a similar event the next day, but now it's not between an Egyptian and a Hebrew, but between two Hebrews. And here Moses tries to mediate between the two Israelites. And it's interesting that later, when he's taking the Israelites through the wilderness, he is also mediator there. And it's interesting that the later Israelites have the same response that this Israelite does. The later Israelites say, "Who do you make yourself out to be? Who put you in charge?" So there's that same tension in this situation. Here is an ironic statement. Who may be prince or judge over us? See, here's what Stephen, I think, was commenting on in Acts chapter 7. That God is going to place Moses in this court position. That God is going to appoint him to deliver the nation. But they are not going to recognize that. Remember when Moses and Aaron come back from the desert, the people don't want them to do it. Who are you to be us? Who has put you in this position? Okay, note what happens, verse 15. When Pharaoh heard of it, he sought to kill Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh and stayed in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. Because Moses killed the Egyptian, Pharaoh tries to kill Moses. I think this verse is a pointer to what would happen later, that Israel that the Egyptians would later be killed. That Israel would flee, and they would flee to the land of Midian. And so we see Moses here, in a sense, almost a microcosm of what later happens to Israel. The Egyptians are killed in Egypt, and Pharaoh attempts to kill them. They flee to Midian. That's exactly what's going on here with Moses. And I think what's part of this, again, is that Moses is being placed in a position of preparation. He flees Egypt. He flees out into Midian. And he's there for 40 years. And I think it's a time of preparation. He knows Egypt. He knows the escape routes out of Egypt. He knows Midian. He knows Sinai. He knows where the watering holes are. He knows where the food is. He's going to be out there for 40 years. God is preparing him to bring his people there, as he had Moses in the Egyptian court for 40 years. 40 years of preparation. So that when he comes back, he will do battle against the Egyptians. Now, let's continue. Look at verses 16 and following. Now, he sat down by the well. Okay, that's important. You know, there are all these well stories in the Old Testament. And why is that? Because he needs water and there's not a lot of it. And so here he is by a well. That's where people congregate. That's where people bring their flocks and so forth. Now, it says, now the priest of Midian had seven daughters. And they came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. The shepherds came, drove them away, but Moses stood up to save them and watered their flock. When they came home to their father, Reuel, he said, how is it that you have come home so soon today? They said, an Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds and even drew water for us and watered the flock. Said to his daughters, then where is he? Why have you left the man? Call him that he may eat bread. Now here we see the development, I think, of the character of the man Moses and traits that make him one to deliver God's people. In fact, I would argue again, this little story is a microcosm of the Exodus event. Here are the daughters of Reuel are oppressed and are driven away from the water. They are oppressed by these stronger shepherds. Moses stands up and it says, he delivers them. The word there in Hebrew is Yashab, salvation. He saves them from the oppressors. And then he nurtures their flock and he waters their flocks. These seven daughters are in need of deliverance. Of course, they are oppressed. Nowhere in the story do we find Reuel or Jethro has any sons. He has seven daughters. And Hebrew readers would look at that, knowing number seven means completion. He's got lots of daughters, but he's got no sons. Okay, so they're in an oppressive situation. And so Moses is the one who delivers from oppressors. Now, we need to deal with two things here. You just kind of decide. I think they're kind of interesting, so let's think about it. Now, how come, why is this guy's name Reuel here in verse 18, but chapter 3, verse 1, his name is Jethro? That's your little name, Jethro. You ever watch Beverly Hills? Cypher and Memphis. Okay. This is the same guy. Some have argued, two different people, but that's difficult to support textually. They are likely one and the same. Jethro is probably his priestly official name. Look down at verse 1 of chapter 3. Now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law, Jethro, the priest of Midian. So that's his priestly name. His common name, therefore, would be Reuel. Now, this is quite common in the Old Testament. You have official names as well as common names. So Solomon, by the way, has two names. David has two names. Most of the kings of Israel have two names. So that's one way to answer that, and I think it's correct. The second thing I want to point out here, I think it's kind of interesting, verse 19, when Jethro says to them, why come home so soon? And they said, well, the Egyptian delivered us. Interesting, isn't it? How would they know that? Why would they identify Moses as an Egyptian? How do what? How do they know he was an Egyptian? The way he dressed, okay.
The way he talks.
The way he talks. I'll talk to good Egyptian. See if anyone knows this. If you were looking at a carpet in Egypt, how would you know someone was an Egyptian and another person was an Asiatic or a Hebrew? Mark, John? Very good. Ooh, very good. Egyptian is clean shaven. Hebrews are not. And so, this is a false identification because it's not. Okay, now, look what happens in the story, verses 21 and 23. And Moses was content to dwell with the man, and he gave Moses his daughter Zipporah. She gave birth to a son. He called his name Gershom, for he said, I have been a sojourner in a foreign land. He married Zipporah, who later becomes a great strength to Moses in the trying situation that we will talk about. Weeks. She bears a son, names him Gershom, and his name, just like that, most Hebrew names, when they name their children, they're purposeful names. They're names for an event that has happened, or they're naming something that's going to occur. Isaiah names his son Ahur Shalal Hashabaz. Swift is the booty, speedy is the prey. Call me speedy for short. Because he was saying the Assyrian army is coming swiftly. Okay, so they would name their children. But we see that in the case here with Gershom. His name in Hebrew literally means a stranger there. A stranger there. I have been a stranger in a foreign land. The question I have is this. What land is he talking about? I have been a stranger in a foreign land. Is he referring to Egypt? Is he referring to Midian? Could it be a reference to the fact that the Israelites are slaves, have no land that they're coming? He's not talking about where he is. He's talking about where God's people are. I have been a stranger in a foreign land, and God's people are yet strangers in a foreign land. But you know, he could have also meant something else. Hebrews 11:13. These all died in faith, not having received the things promised, but having seen them and greeted them from afar, and having acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. There's the word. Being a stranger in a foreign land. So as we look at this passage of Moses, he's talking about God's people here in the Old Testament, that they are strangers in a foreign land, and yet so are we. And yet, so are we. We are strangers in the world. And then, I think what supports that idea, the last last three verses of the chapter. During those many days, the king of Egypt died, and the people of Israel groaned. They sighed because of their slavery, and cried out for help. Their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God. And God heard their groaning. God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. That last word in Hebrew is like getting slapped in the face. You see, there's no object. God knew. And that verb in Hebrew also often indicates intimacy. When it says in the Bible, Adam and Eve had relations, it says Adam knew his wife Eve. It indicates this great intimacy. So it's here. God saw the people of Israel and God knew. God had intimacy with them. He was in relation with them. He remembered his covenant with them. The promise that had been given some 500 or 600 years before Moses, God remembered his covenant to his people and he passed upon them. And so the writer will not let us forget about the Hebrews in Egypt. I have been a stranger in a foreign land, and my people are yet strangers in a foreign land. Now, let me just mention one last thing, and I'll be done. The next time we're together in a couple of weeks, we'll be looking at the call of Moses and burning bush. But I want to mention Moses' life can be divided into three segments. There's the 40 years in Egypt, the 40 years in Midian, and then when he goes to get Israel out of Egypt, in the 40 years, he leads them through the wilderness. Moses lived to be 120, according to Deuteronomy 34:7. He had these three segments of 40. And the number 40 in Hebrew is symbolic of testing. Symbolic of trial. The first trial is Moses in Egypt. The second trial is Moses in Midian. And the third and greatest trial is Moses leading the people through the wilderness of the promised land. Okay, let's end with prayer, please. Father, we thank you for the story that tells us you do not forget your people. You do not abandon your people. But you remember your covenant. The covenant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Your promises to your people, Israel. And indeed, your promises to your church. Thank you that we are in covenant with you. Pray this in Jesus' name.